Today's edition of the Daily Caller podcast is brought to you by Life Change Tea.
Why go to getthetea.com? Because this important news could change your life. Socrates made a statement saying that all disease starts in the gut. Take care of your gut, and well, the rest speaks for itself. Life Change Tea is a wonderful way to aid in your digestion. Brew it, steep it, drink it, and feel it go to work. We at Life Change Tea have been around for years helping people just like you feel better. Lots of testimonials and lots of happy people. Log on to getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. Getthetea.com.
Alrighty, hello again, everyone. Welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller podcast for the 28th day of what month is it? Of April 2020. It's all bleeding together. I knew it's a weekday because I'm recording the show. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for listening, tuning in, telling a friend, and all that good stuff. Big action-packed program for you today. We sit down and, well, we didn't sit down. Well, I was sitting down. But we talked to Dr. Wilfred Riley, who is a professor of political science at Kentucky State University. He's been on the show before. He's got the book Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. And we talk about some things that you're not allowed to talk about. In fact, they'll get you kicked off YouTube if you talk about them. It is the coronavirus and whether or not lockdowns are working. He's done a quick study of states that locked down versus states that didn't lock down and versus countries that locked down versus countries that didn't lock down. The results are very, very interesting. Plus, we talk about the 1619 project of the New York Times. It's just this liberal indoctrination crap. And his own involvement in the 1776 project. And we talk about everything in between. It is a good interview. It's a great time. And you will like it. So there you go. You can email me, Derek at dailycaller.com. Like I said, I intended it to be like a half an hour. And it ended up going an hour because it was just enjoyable. And so you will enjoy it as well, I think. So before we get to it, we'll get right to it. Before we get to it, I got to tell you about Life Change Tea, our lovely, lovely sponsor. You go to getthetea.com. You pick out your flavor of tea. You get it. Suddenly, it's the tea that makes you go. Suddenly, you use as directed. Don't overdo it. Suddenly, you find yourself being more regular and feeling better and going, hey, why do I have more energy? That's because you're cleaned out. Your body can absorb more of the nutrition and the food that you consume, and that translates to a little bit more pep in your old step. Go to getthetea.com. Choose your flavor. Choose what you need done. They have a whole line of fine products there. Enter promo code Derek, spelled D-E-R-E-K, at checkout. Click apply. You get free fast shipping on top of a great deal for a great product. Don't forget promo code Derek at getthetea.com. And then we will all, my daughter is freaking out because she's playing an iPad game because it's good stuff. I drink it. I have a gallon of it sitting in the fridge. It does put a little more pep in my step. Before we get to Dr. Wilfred Riley, since Quinn is right here, Quinn, do you want to say anything to the people?
And then baby, he gets missing. Go put the X on you, then again the X a minute.
Yeah. Everybody now knows how to play the baby kitty cat game on the iPad. You wait for the X when the ad plays. She's a quick learner. She already knows the alphabet song at 2. I'm still iffy. Anyway, without any further ado, because it was so enjoyable, I present the interview with Dr. Wilfred Riley. We've been doing this mess, this lockdown, this isolation, whatever you want to call it, this prison, this crazy time, this me time. We're checking in with people around the country and picking their brains and seeing what they're up to. And today's guest is a returning champion. He's been on the show. He was actually supposed to be on the show the week the lockdown started. But, you know, you want to make God laugh, make a plan. It's Dr. Wilfred Riley. He's professor of political science at Kentucky State University, also author of the book Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. That's why he was on the show before, and now he's back. How you doing, Wilfred?
Doing pretty well, honestly. I mean, I'm fairly young. I'm healthy. I'm in one of the red southern states. So, I mean, The lockdown here, I mean, about half of our businesses are open as essential. People are out much of the day exercising. I'm using the time to get a lot of my research done. I'm thinking about putting together a third book. I've had some articles out there. So yeah, I mean, there's nothing really too terrible going on. I'm in a pretty good place. We're right now in Kentucky. There's a lot of question about when our lockdown order, essentially the healthy at home, is going to expire or be lifted. I mean, we've seen Georgia essentially drop theirs. Tennessee, I believe, has given theirs up. So there's a lively debate about whether we should be next in kind of that line of the SEC states.
It's all about college football, college sports. The most important question, of course, right off the top, you've been able to get toilet paper.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I thought the whole run on toilet paper was kind of silly. I'm not a soldier by background, but I mean, I've spent a fair amount of time traveling. You can, you know, wipe your butt with a piece of cloth or some leaves if you have to. I mean, I would have gotten some rice and
beans. You could stuff leaves.
First of all, coronavirus doesn't
cause diarrhea. But secondly, leaves, come on, hop in the shower, dude. Where are you going to the bathroom that there isn't a bathtub?
The whole point, though, is, I mean, if you think the world's going to end, I don't think what you need is toilet paper and dog treats.
I hadn't seen a run on dog treats, but now I might have to go to the store just in case you're onto something. No, it is crazy. I actually did score some toilet paper today, and I bought it out of habit. It was just weird. I was at Target, and I thought, it's here. There's not a lot. I should buy some because you never know, and, you know, sell it on eBay or whatever. But my friend Brian is probably going to pick it up because he's out. The reason I wanted to have you back on, aside from just checking in on the middle of the country, as they call it, flyover country, is you wrote a very interesting piece on Spiked. And this is one of the debates that is raging constantly. And you see it played out. There are people on television who tell us we can't leave our houses again unless and until there is a vaccine. So just get used to the lockdown. And then there are people who tell you, come on in, the water's fine. Let's everybody go outside. This is the biggest hoax ever perpetrated. Somewhere in between lies reality. Where that reality is up for debate. But you address a piece of that reality that has, I think, the whole country sort of on edge, and it's the lockdown. There are states that did not lock down, and then there are states like I'm in Maryland where it's only essential. You can only go to certain places. I grew up in Michigan, and you couldn't even buy seeds. You weren't allowed to buy paint. The governor there had large portions of stores roped off because it was verboten. You cannot go over there. And it was all, everything that's being done is in the name of public safety. But that begs the question, is public safety being served? And you looked at the actual data there from a, not a dispassionate, but from a scientific point of view, just from running the numbers rather than somebody with a particular agenda. Tell us what you found.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you mentioned, this piece was for Spiked. That's a British, pretty well-known, primarily online magazine. They publish a lot of quantitative pieces. They publish a lot of writing about COVID-19. And what I did for them after a conversation with Fraser Myers over there was literally just look at whether there is evidence that a state's locking down rather than just practicing kind of well-done social distancing, which I think really all the states are doing, has a significant impact on how they fight COVID-19. And what I find, and I'm going to give all the caveats about this analysis and so on, but it's not really. So I do three or four things. The first is just look at cases and deaths, bluntly. So there are, as you mentioned, you could argue between 7 and 9 states that never really shut down. I mean, there's a pretty well-known CBS News piece that lists 7 of them. And that includes Utah, Nebraska, Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, a couple of others. You also have South Carolina, which did finally issue a shelter-in-place order, but which took until April 6th to do that. And you have Oklahoma, which for a couple of technical reasons wasn't in the CBS piece, but never really shut down either. So you've got a pretty substantial block of states that did not practice this lockdown technique, and then you've got other states that did. So I look at the non-lockdown social distancing states in terms of cases and deaths, And kind of getting to the point, I find that there are on average 1,613 COVID cases in the non-lockdown states, and there are 33 deaths on average in the non-lockdown states. So I then took that entire line of 40 plus other states and broke down their mean and median averages, and I found that there were 8,408 COVID cases on average in the non-lockdown states, with New York removed. New York's doing even worse, and 342 deaths on average, and this is in the lockdown states, sorry. So the social distancing non-lockdown states were frankly doing better than the lockdown states. It was 1,600 versus 8,000. So the next question, obviously, as a social scientist, as a guy who's into quantitative methods, was, well, it's got to be the case that the social distancing states are smaller. You're mostly talking about heartland states. So I threw in a complete adjustment for population. I look at cases and deaths per million. And results are pretty much the same. I mean, what I find is that the gap shuts a little bit, but in the social distancing, absolutely no lockdown states, you're averaging 729 cases per million and 12 deaths per million people. Whereas in the lockdown states, you're averaging 1,392 cases per million people and 54 deaths per million people. So again, the non-lockdown states seem to be doing better. And I wasn't terribly surprised by this. Well done, social distancing works if you look at Sweden. But I wanted to check this at another level. So I put together what's called a regression model, where the dependent variables, if you will, were number of cases in a state and number of deaths in a state, which is probably a better measure. And the independent variables by this point included population in hundreds of thousands, population density, income, age, diversity, percentage of minorities in the population, and then shutdown strategy. Did they lock down or no? And what I found there is that with everything in, the relationship between strategy and cases and deaths was completely, as we'd call it, statistically insignificant. At this point, the shutdown states or the social distancing states didn't have a massive advantage, but there was certainly no disadvantage. There was no correlation between lockdowns and any improvement in terms of cases or deaths. So that was the math in the little piece. And then I extended that overseas. I mean, I looked at Sweden, looked at Japan. I looked at this number of large countries that have never shut down. And it's pretty much the same thing. I mean, Sweden had 1,309 COVID cases per million people when I took that look, that survey, as versus Norway, as I recall, had 1,274 per million, and Denmark had 1,221. So there was maybe a very slight edge for the lockdown, but it was minuscule. These no statistically significant difference. And again, Sweden was able to keep their economy. So when I ran through all these analyses, I mean, we're at four right now, I couldn't really see much evidence that, at the very least, that places that did not choose to lock down are experiencing any kind of catastrophe. And in fact, the evidence didn't show much of an advantage for lockdowns. It didn't show an advantage for lockdowns at all.
That's what was most interesting about this, is that it's just straight up math. There's no guessing as to why. But in listening to you explain it and listening and reading your piece, what I found curious is the two things that we're hearing about a lot in this country is population density. New York, New Jersey, hardest hit. It's because people are living on top of each other. But when you adjusted for that, you still didn't see a benefit to locking down, or actually, did you not only not see a benefit to locking down, did you see harm in locking down if you're putting more and more people inside of a sardine can that is, you know, an apartment building with 300 apartments or with 300 people living in it? Could that be a factor? I'm just, because density is one of those things that jumps out to you. Of course, New York City is hard hit. People live on top of each other there. New Jersey is the most densely populated state we have. Of course, they're hardest hit. But then Detroit, where I grew up, is you could grow farms in the middle of the city, and they are growing farms in the middle of the city. Yet you have a situation where it was hit hard
as well. So it's not necessarily doesn't seem to be people living on top of each other, but that would be where people's minds would immediately go when you think of Chicago, New York, New Jersey.
Well, there may be some outliers. I mean, I will say Detroit has not generally been the best governed city in the world. I mean, there are a lot of things that could come into play there. Getting crazy. But no, yeah. I mean, but yeah. Overall, though, I mean, I do want to emphasize there were things that were significant in the analysis. I mean, so population was highly significant. I mean, when we talk about p-values, what are the odds that the relationship that you found isn't real, it occurs by random chance? I mean, the odds of that would be something like 0.6% when it comes to population. Population was a highly significant predictor of coronavirus cases and deaths. And population density separately came pretty close to being significant, as we say, even with population in the model. So overall, you're absolutely right. The more people you have in an area, the more you're going to have an issue with COVID. As I recall, looking at the coefficients in the model, every additional 100,000 people in an area, with everything else adjusted for, kind of set at the average, correlated with more than 1,000 new cases of COVID-19. And that's true almost no matter what strategy you pursued, because there are large urban areas in the set of non-lockdown states as well. So if you have more people, you're going to have more of an issue with a disease of density like COVID. I mean, I will say this is something that's serious. You don't want to play games with it. But I'm not entirely sure that a large city that went with very well done social distancing would see many more deaths than a large city that went with a lockdown, but with all these exceptions for essential jobs and essential employees and so on. We haven't really had a chance to test that too often. But whatever big cities do, they're going to see more cases and they're going to see more deaths because there are more people. And it's at least understandable why they opted to err on the side of caution. The real question with lockdowns, I think, comes for most of the rest of the country. I mean, when I looked at Montana during this analysis, as I recall, they were in a full-on lockdown under Bullock, the Democratic governor. They had 14 deaths. So there are a lot of regional questions to be asked. I mean, does this make sense in this context? But overall, the more people you have, yeah, the more risk of COVID at some level you're going to experience. That is just math.
Is there anything in the math that gives an indication as to why California just did so well? I mean, let's be honest. There are more deaths on Long Island than the entire state of California. 40 million people versus, what, 1.5 million people? That doesn't make sense if you just look at it from a 30,000-foot view. But somehow California has managed to, with a lockdown that's almost irrelevant just because other places, New York was locked down, but with a lockdown, they managed to have so few deaths and so few cases.
Well, I think there are a couple things. I mean, so first of all, if California and New York are both locked down, then logically the lockdown is probably not the reason for California's success. Again, just in terms of how you look at an analysis like this. I would say, though, I actually pulled up Worldometer's coronavirus right now while we're talking, and I think New York is more the exception than California. I mean, so if you look at this right here, I mean, in the entire United States, there are only 950,000 actual fully documented COVID-19 cases, and there are 54,000 deaths. Now, of those, about 300,000 of the cases and an incredible 22,000 of the deaths are just in New York. Then you add in New Jersey. New Jersey's got 105,523 cases, and they've got about 6,000 deaths. So if you look at those figures, out of 54,000 deaths, 28,000 are essentially in New York and the New Jersey suburbs of New York. So the question to be asked is, why did that happen there? And to some extent, there may almost be an element of dark bad luck to that, as we saw with Lombardy in Italy. I mean, there has to be an epicenter to any epidemic. There has to be a center point on any mathematical chart. But New York also is the place. I mean, I'm from Chicago. You're from Detroit, other huge cities. But New York is kind of number one, as much as we hate to say that. I mean, they're the city where all international air travel, or more than half of it, enters the USA. I mean, they're one of those cities that, unlike LA or Chicago, very specifically decided we're not going to give in to the culture of the car. We're going to be almost undrivable. We're going to have trains like the six that go around the whole city. So I think when New York got hit, they had a lot of cases very early on, and they had a lot of things like, I don't think they've shut down passenger rail yet. They had a lot of things that almost couldn't help but spread the disease. You can't social distance on an L train. So I don't think it's that California is doing anything that's particularly unique, although I don't want to just do too much pure speculation. I think it's that New York and New Jersey, for whatever reason, are very different from America overall, the rest of America. So, I mean, if you look at California, actually is the fourth hardest hit state. I mean, I haven't adjusted for population yet right now. But I mean, California's got fully 42,000 cases. I mean, that's a hit of Pennsylvania, which is huge. Michigan, where you're from, Illinois. California has more cases than Florida. The issue is just that New York is an amazing outlier where half of the deaths are concentrated. I mean, in many large states like Kentucky, we've just now hit 200 deaths.
From a social science standpoint, and just looking at society, for a long time, the environmental movement is trying to hurt. New York was the model. No cars, fewer cars, all taxis or cars. Public transportation, heavy public transportation, concentrated living. They were opposed to rural living. You don't, what do you need land for? It just causes you to burn fossil fuel to get anywhere. Is that kind of dead now, do you think?
I mean, I think that unintentionally what happened during COVID-19 is an extraordinary argument for what some of my friends might call the trad format of living. I mean, boy, private cars are by far, during any disease crisis, the safest way to get around. I mean, we all kind of make jokes about people that are in their car with their mask on, but, you know, they probably don't need the mask. But that's a zero risk situation. I am not, so I mean, I'm a fairly healthy mid-30s male. I mean, my risk of death if I got COVID-19 would be about 1 in 500, so I'm not especially terrified of the disease. But I will tell you, I mean, I would have some questions about taking the New York subway. I mean, those are some of the rare situations where an ordinary healthy person mask around their neck would be at actual real risk. So I think COVID-19 has kind of highlighted that. Like, we very definitely in the USA, like, we both jokingly were talking about major places like Louisville and Detroit, and we're using terms like flyover land. There definitely is an urban chauvinism in the USA, where there's an incredible arrogance in the great places on the coast. I mean, New York, LA, DC. And we often hear that this is the model to adopt. I mean, everyone takes the subway. We don't need these polluting cars. I mean, you live in large buildings full of thousands of people across all generations. And in fact, I mean, living on some land where you can do things rather than go crazy right now during this time with a private car and a same age romantic partner is the safest thing to do by far. I mean, that's
it really is. Yeah. Look, I grew up in Detroit. You're given a Bob Seger record when you're born and you're taught how to drive before you're taught how to walk. That's just the law in Michigan. But one of the things that you mentioned on when you're testing for, and I'd be remiss if I didn't bring this up, is the diversity aspect of a state. Because a lot of people could say, well, this is hitting black people a lot harder than it's hitting white people. This is hitting Mexican or Hispanic people much harder than it's hitting white people or Asian people. So maybe the higher concentrations of them live in New York, New Jersey area rather than Iowa or Idaho or what have you. But you corrected for that, because this is, let's face it, I don't like the idea of this. As soon as I knew that we were going to get this data, I knew it was going to happen. It made it seem like some people would care more and some people would care less. You should just care that human beings are dying. But when trying to analyze an outbreak in an epidemic like this, you have to look at all the data. You have to collect as much data as possible. Mm-hmm. So what about the diversity of states and of metropolitan areas in your data? Because we're told that African Americans are more likely to get it and more likely to die of it, still infinitesimal on the death side with everybody, thank God. But in the number of cases, how did that factor in your analysis?
Yeah, I do think you made one very important point in passing there, which is that there are not an extraordinarily large number of COVID-19 deaths. I think we both agree. Obviously, it goes without saying, nobody wants anybody to die. you know, any human death is a tragedy. But there are a total of about 56,000 COVID-19 deaths. I mean, final projection for the epidemic this year is about 100,000, which is on par with past sort of new flu disease epidemics like 57, 58. We're not going to catch 18, 19. So this is, of course, terrible. But I mean, it's worth remembering that 8,000 people die every day. 2.8 to 3.1 million people die every year. I think in part we don't notice this because we don't have a panic-inducing, you know, bone cancer tracker or something like that that's up on every TV station like the COVID-19 trackers from Worldometers and the CDC are. What would that figure be like for opiates in a typical year? I mean, that'd probably be right on par with COVID. But moving beyond that, yeah, you asked about this diversity variable. I threw a variable that represents diversity in my regression model because there'd been so much talk about whether people of color are harder hit. I'm a man of color myself. I'm a black guy. Teach at a historically black college, in fact. And I was curious about that. I mean, but in the model, I adjust for some of the things that probably explain that difference, if we're being honest, like social class and population. And long story short, when I do that, diversity, and I measured this crudely, it's just the number of minorities in the state, it has no impact on COVID-19 cases or deaths. And I'd say three really quick things about that. I mean, first, that at least strongly implies, again, no model, including mine, is perfect, that a lot of what was seen as a race effect is a class effect or an urban effect. So if you say, well, 30% of the deaths are of African Americans, which is the last figure I saw in the CDC, and blacks are only about 15% of the population, you know, explain that, you know, with an allegation of racism waiting, the easy response would be, well, half of these deaths come from a massive integrated urban area. I mean, we're talking literally about New York City. So first, I don't see much effect when you adjust for urban area and when you adjust for income. If you look at some of the working poor white states, I mean, I recently saw data from Minnesota, 86% Caucasian. Kentucky, I mean, I would assume if you look at the Appalachian region of the state, our figures are going to be very similar to that. You're not going to see a lot of white privilege in Appalachia, if you will. So that's point one. Point two also is that to seriously make a claim about racism at the current moment in healthcare or something like that, you'd have to demonstrate that blacks, whites, and Asians had identical starting levels of obesity, asthma, so on down the line. That seems almost impossible to do quickly. And my understanding is that many people of color concentrated in the U.S. South and so on do worse on most of those measures. And the third thing that you're really not supposed to talk about is everyone following the set of quarantine rules to the same extent? And obviously, I don't think there's a purely racial element to this, but African Americans, for example, are a much younger population than whites. The most common age, the modal age for a black person in the USA is 27. For a white person, I think it's 58. So in terms of people that are more likely to be out at parties, playing ball in the park, this kind of thing, that's going to be younger people, and that's thus disproportionately going to be people of color. So you can't really say anything about racism until you adjust for all of these other things that are different between large, complex groups. And in social science, we'd call that being multivariate. Just pointing at a black guy and pointing at a white guy and saying, well, the white guy earns 10% more money doesn't establish racism. That's one of the things I write about well beyond COVID-19.
You wrote a whole couple of books on it. And probably a third one coming soon, now that you've got the time on your hands. But, so when you set out to do this, what changed in your mind between what you thought you'd find and what you actually found when you were crunching these numbers? Was there anything that stuck out where you're walking into it, and then you walk out and you go, oh, my God, I didn't know that, or that's not what I would have expected to find?
Well, my starting hypothesis was that lockdowns would have either a small effect or no effect. Now, I've mentioned this data set's available to anyone that wants to see it. I'm a pretty ethical researcher, so if I'd been wrong, I just would have, well, actually, you often don't publish if you're wrong, I mean, in terms of, you know, who's willing to pick it up. But I would have written the thing anyway and said, well, I was wrong. But in fact, it turned out that I was, at least in the context of this one limited model, that I was right. And I think to some extent, there's an element of the self-explanatory to this. I mean, if you look at the footage from Utah or from the open beaches in rural California or from Sweden, you don't see corpses littering the streets. I mean, without being glib or making jokes, I mean, we understand that in all of the United States, minus New York and New Jersey, there are, I mean, what would this break down to? 30,000 COVID-19 deaths. So it, to some extent, it seemed fairly apparent that South Carolina or Utah or Nebraska, even though those are fairly well-populated states, wasn't in the midst of total collapse. So I wasn't too surprised by what I found, but I thought it was important to empirically look at it. And again,
let's put on your political science.
Oh, sorry, go on.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, just, I well, mean, let's... and again, no one project of this kind can perfectly answer these questions. I mean, so people have noted by email, well, you might want to look at current active cases of COVID rather than all cases all time. Or you might want to include what's called a date of onset variable to mark exactly when this started. And you could find some differences between states. Or people have mentioned, well, it does also look like post-lockdown cases in the lockdown states have been growing at a somewhat slower rate than they are in the social distancing states. Although I will say right off the bat, that's because the social distancing states mostly had a coherent plan from pretty early on, and there were so few cases to begin with. I mean, so if Wyoming goes from 3 to 6, that's a 200% or a 100% increase. But I mean, we can talk about all of those mathematical points. I actually am planning on doing a follow-up to this piece. But I think at the most basic level, if you look at Sweden or you look at Nebraska, you certainly don't see a worse disease environment than you see in New York. And that's what at least this first round of data found.
Well, let's put it on your political scientist hat then, since you do have a PhD in that, and ask you the $64 trillion question. Why is it that everywhere has to shut down then? When you just look at the difference between the two, it's a political question. It's not a science question. Is it that New York rules the day? That's where the media is. They scare the ever-loving crap out of everybody, and they sort of dictate how the country goes?
First of all, I don't think every place does have to shut down. One of the things I will say about this, I mean, If I get a large journal article out of this, although that's obviously the goal is more contributing to discourse than publishing things and appearing smart, but I'd be very interested in co-writing that with a doctor so we can weight kind of one another's biases and, you know, build on one another's strengths. Like, I'm not a medical man. I wouldn't presume to comment on something like whether COVID-19 can be transmitted, you know, aerosolically, you know, through the air. But I do think that when it comes to, I guess what I'm saying is I'm about to give an opinion here. When it comes to policy questions or methodological questions, I don't necessarily know that doctors are better policymakers than governors or better methodologists than, you know, psychologists or physicists. So when you ask, why does every place have to shut down? I don't necessarily think every place does have to shut down. I mean, there's an extremely strong case for kind of regional solutions. The goal with anything that you're doing to contain disease is keeping what's called R or RO below 1 or around 1. Each person with the disease infects one person or fewer during X period of time. But the simple reality is that if you look at Arkansas, for example, or Wyoming, I mean, they might very well be able to do that just by practicing social distancing in mid-sized cities where people are obeying the rules. In New York City on the 6th, that would be a lot more difficult. So you do, to me, need different strategies for those different places. It's insane to say you don't. In terms of why everybody shut down, I think the answer is panic, fear. I mean, I think that we want to be sympathetic to that desire to help people, to save lives, however you want to describe it. But the simple reality is that looking through this list of shutdown states, there were states on there that I did not expect to see. I mean, Montana, Vermont. Vermont is apparently another state where you can't buy seeds, by the way. Can't go to the garden center. Maine, Alaska. I mean, you have to take a plane to Alaska. I mean, it seems to me they'd have some very easy ways of regulating their border and their airspace.
You go to Alaska to socially distance in a good time to be around nobody. Unless a bear is giving it to you, you really have to try to get it in Alaska.
Yeah, I mean, Alaska, and by the way, I mean, in terms of, I'm an outdoors guy to some extent, I mean, it sounds like a great place, but I mean, Alaska has one city, Anchorage. I mean, so there were many states that adopted very hardcore shelter-in-place lockdowns where there's not a lot of empirical evidence that that was necessary, and I do think the reason for that was fear. Have you heard the name Neil Ferguson?
Yes. He did a hell of a job on that first model and really was the first domino to fall.
Yeah, I assumed you had, obviously. I mean, I think most of the well-read journalists and so on that I've talked to are familiar with the papers around this. But I think what you really had with COVID-19 was a situation where two estimates came out really early that induced straight-up panic. The first was that WHO estimate based on what we now know to be very flawed Chinese data of, what was it, 3.4% lethality rate for COVID-19. So if you get it across all ages, 4% of people die. That was one. The other was Neil Ferguson. He assumed only a 1% death rate. But as I recall, he also assumed that 80% of people would get the bug. And he also assumed that at least at first, countries would do virtually nothing to mitigate. And he came up with this estimate of 2.2 million deaths. So these papers came out immediately. And I think, in fact, I know the media blew them up into this sort of potential apocalyptic narrative storyline. And that's why Alaska shut down. I mean, that is it. And while we're talking about this at, I mean, a pretty serious level, a pretty high level, I mean, we now know that most of that information is false. Ferguson's a good methodologist. I'm not, you know, accusing him of anything but at all. But I mean, the estimate that 80% of people would get COVID-19, I mean, we now know, for example, there's a cruise ship, the Diamond Princess, where there was a COVID-19 outbreak that just sailed around for a couple months because no one wanted to, or weeks, because no one wanted to take in this boat full of people with COVID. The final infection rate there was 17%. I mean, a lot of projections for the whole USA now, given mitigation, are between 25 and 40%. We now also know Americans and Brits will mitigate. I mean, that's what we've been doing for a month. Even that 1% fatality rate seems to be pretty badly off. The issue there is what we call a denominator issue. I mean, the first death rates were coming from the people that took the COVID-19 tests. But to take a COVID-19 test in America until I think last week, certainly in Kentucky, you had to be someone who was visibly sick and symptomatic. You had to have had direct contact with someone that had COVID-19, and you'd be required to demonstrate that, to give a name. And you had to yourself call a hospital and go through this scary 30-minute screening process. And a lot of people have estimated, well, there must be 50 or 100 people with mild cases of the disease for everyone to take those tests. And we're now finding out that's pretty much true. I mean, there was a study done in Miami recently, as I understand, good study, low false positive test. And they found that 6 or 7% of people have antibodies for COVID-19, meaning that they've undisputably had the disease at some point or another. And I mean, the entire state of Florida has 30,000 COVID-19 cases, 30,839, with a small minority of those being concentrated in Miami. And that implies the actual fatality rate for COVID-19 is on the order of 0.2%, on par with a very bad flu year. And I mean, I'm kind of going on here, but essentially these papers kind of shut down the normal functioning of the world. And by the way, you see the impact that sort of wonky science can have in that sentence I just said right there. Yeah. And we now know that a lot of that stuff was wrong.
It was way wrong, yet politicians and the media refused to correct course. It's as if you're on a plane, a boat. We'll just say you're on the Titanic, and you say that, hey, a day and a half ahead of here, on this path, there is a giant iceberg that's going to take us out. And they don't adjust. They still don't adjust. There doesn't seem to be, and I'm asking from your political science perspective rather than the straight up analytical perspective. Now, what is the reluctance to exhale a little bit, or more importantly, to allow the public to exhale? Because it really still is, from a politician standpoint, in Michigan, Governor Whitmer extended for another 2 weeks, the lockdown. Here in Maryland, the lockdown is indefinite, but it's, you know, sort of living 2 weeks at a time, even though technically it's indefinite. Other states have extended it further. They seem unwilling to accept not even the new reality, but a better understanding of reality.
Well, Governor Whitmer seems to be pursuing kind of a Red Queen lockdown strategy. I mean, she was the one that banned seeds and put police caution tape up in front of the garden.
She kept marijuana stores open, though. You know, yeah, buying weed and lottery tickets is essential. Being able to grow food, not so much.
And we can talk about a lot of that stuff. I mean, abortion clinics were considered essential in some states. Liquor stores are everywhere. You know, on the right, gun stores are. What are we as human beings? But I mean, Whitmer in particular has done some things. I mean, she implied she was going to extend the shelter in place order because she was protested. I mean, so there's been kind of a silly back and forth in Michigan between, you know, her and the local right that I'm not really going to get into. But why are people so reluctant? I think that there are two motivators. One is just cowardice, or put more politely, a desire for more facts. So we live in the modern media era where nothing's ever forgotten and the internet lives forever, right? So, I mean, nobody wants to be the person responsible for issuing an order that could lead to any death. And to some extent, I think this comes from a place of not understanding trade-offs, because if you don't issue that order at some point, you're going to be responsible for massive economic collapse that will cause deaths. But at the most basic level, that's the level of analysis. No one wants to be the person that opened the borders and then led to the party that led to the resurge. And you know how the media is going to play this, by the way. I mean, you've seen a lot of popular Republican governors in places like Georgia and Florida doing things like opening beaches and opening, you know, restaurant strips and so on. And if there's any increase in COVID-19 at all, the story is going to be people die because of Governor Kemp, you know, Felmet 5. With, you know, people saying things like
Colorado is reopening and you wouldn't even know it. Colorado with a Democratic governor is reopened today and you wouldn't even know it.
Actually, that's the first mention I've heard of that. So that did go through.
Okay. he's wow. Doing phase one right now.
Full phase one. Okay. No. So, I mean, you definitely do. I mean, we've talked about this. I mean, I wouldn't describe myself as radically right, but I'm a businessman who owns a couple of guns. I mean, the U.S. media is a joke very often. You know, 93% of mass media coverage of Trump at one point had been negative of President Trump. And I think that kind of thing, that kind of slant or bias, if you will, is pretty notable in coverages. I had not heard about Colorado at all. But so the first element is just nobody wants to be the guy who opens things up, sees a 10% increase in cases, and is called a mass murderer. I think that beyond that, though, there is a block of people that would like to use COVID-19 to dramatically change society. And this does get into my own.
Well, and they're unambiguous about that. They are unambiguous about that, as we've seen Joe Biden, Jim Clyburn, other prominent Democrats talk about how this is an opportunity to sort of reorder society. They are always waiting in the wings with a plan. They just need a delivery device. And
5-year, you know,
climate change is a big delivery device. Yeah, 5-year plan. Just a quick re-education camp. It's just a trip. You won't miss anything. But do you think there's an appetite for that in the United States of America? It's sort of, you know, the argument they've been making is Trump failed, which would be that big government failed. So then we need bigger government, which is kind of a tall order.
I think it's an argument that people might or might not go for. It kind of depends how much propaganda they're fed. I mean, one thing that I notice about the gun control debate and the climate change debate and the Black Lives Matter debate and the COVID debate is that the solution is always communism. I mean, it is always, well, we need to go in there and pursue the structural inequalities that allowed this to happen. Student loan funding forgiveness needs to be a major part of the. And watching this as a fairly sympathetic, not unspiritual guy, I mean, my question is, what the hell does any of this have to do with coronavirus? I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a public option for health insurance or something like that. This is crap that's just off some, you know, left of center political wish list. It doesn't have a damn thing to do with COVID. But I mean, I think that there are people that are attempting to say, like, for example, I've heard people, I believe this was Ilhan Omar that linked COVID-19 to reparations. There are higher rates of death in Black communities because there are poor healthcare facilities in Black communities, because Black communities have historically been a little bit poorer.
because blacks and whites used to fight, there were more whites and they won, leading to oppression, because slavery. So, I mean, it's kind of the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon approach. We don't just need to stop COVID-19. We need to fix every systematic problem that could potentially be exacerbated 5% by COVID-19. So I think that there are people, I mean, really there are two. I'm a fan of option one here in the most brutal worst case scenario. There really are two options when it comes to COVID-19. One is that we definitely protect our beloved seniors and those with certain vulnerabilities. We really train people on social distancing so they're not taking stupid risks, maybe get some masks out there, and then we go back to work, one. Or two, we dramatically reshape our society so that for the 8 months or whatever that it takes, say, Gilead to come up with a rapidly developed vaccine, we can survive. And I think that there are a lot of people that are openly advocating for number two, which comes pretty close to full-on communism. I mean, one proposal from the quote-unquote squad was, why don't we just max out our debt completely, print trillion-dollar coins or bills, that part wasn't a joke, and just give everyone a $2,000 check until we've got a vaccine. So, I mean, number two is people intentionally trying massive systemic change.
Well, the left is a series of solutions in search of a problem. And they're ready to go at the drop of a hat. Well, but what you mentioned about Ilhan Omar, exactly. Well, that leads me into something else you're involved in, and that is the 1776 Project, which is a response, a rational response, to the 1619 Project from the New York Times, which always strikes me as odd that a newspaper would have a project with such an agenda as to be a part of the education curriculum of the United States of America, which it is. Yet the 1619 Project has been exposed, there's no other word for it, exposed as having significant historical inaccuracies. I'm trying to put it the most, they fucked up big time. It's a piece of shit. It's just to put it in the scientific terms. They make stuff up. They set out with an agenda and they picked what they needed to fill that agenda and ignored all the inconvenient other facts in there. And the 1776 Project is to counter that. Talk a little bit about the damage that can be done to students and to the fabric of the country if something like the 1619 Project becomes accepted by the population, which there's going to be a huge section of the population that is ready, willing, and able to believe that. But if it becomes common.
Yeah, I mean, so the 1776 Project, as you mentioned, and you can check us out at www.1776unites.org, is, again, I would consider this as much mainstream as conservative. It's a response from the black business and scientific community, really. And obviously, we have many white allies. Welcome more. But to the New York Times 1619 Project, the 1619 Project is a unique thing. I mean, it's an attempt by the New York Times, which is allegedly a neutral and nonpartisan newspaper, to track the founding of America not to the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, but to the arrival of the first British-owned black slaves in America in 1619. And again, even that date could be criticized on a number of grounds. I mean, there were thousands of Iroquois and Portuguese and Spanish slave owners, most of them beautiful people of color, in the United States prior to that date, many of whose descendants remain here today. But that's what the 1619 Project is. It's an attempt to tie virtually everything that is unique about America to slavery. So if you look at the New York Times 1619 Project website, for example, there's an essay called How Historical Segregation Caused Your Traffic Jam. Not sure how that applied to us in Chicago or the Detroit burbs, but there it is. You can
no
see
justice,
it.
No justice, no beeps. No justice, no beeps.
Fair enough. Black cars matter. I mean, but the whole thing, I mean, that's a typical essay, but far more seriously, I mean, at one point, Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's a leading 1619 contributor, claimed that the Revolutionary War was fought in large part, if not primarily, to preserve slavery. That is, not to put too fine a point on it, false. Slavery remained legal in the overseas possessions of the British Empire for 52 years after U.S. Revolutionary War proved successful. But anyway, we don't need to go through this point by point. The goal of 1619 is not just writing a couple of essays. It's taking a certain view of society and inserting it into mainstream middle-class American life. So in coordination with the Pulitzer Center, 1619 has developed a full-on curriculum where each essay is printed out on, you know, in glossy paper form. It's accompanied by a series of questions about it. Their PowerPoint slides and so on that go along with this. And the curriculum is to some extent scary. It asks questions like, what is national memory and how can we change it? So 1776 was a response to that. And 1776 essentially is, and we, again, business background for many people, we plan on doing some of the same things like a curriculum, like media content, but is a group that presents a positive and diverse view of the United States of America, diverse in the classical sense. So, I mean, some of our arguments are, we need to be honest about slavery and segregation, but those aren't the primary things that shaped the USA. Virtually every country historically has had slaves. Only one became the USA. It's our freedom, constitution, et cetera, that sets us apart. Bill of Rights, notably. Second, a lot of the open inaccuracies in that kind of Howard Zinn style social science need to be criticized and need to be taken apart. In fact, it's a subtle form of racism not to do that. And third, we present a positive aspirational view of how to be American. The United States is the world's number one destination for immigration. And people very frequently come here from countries where, without making jokes, cars are a luxury, like Pakistan or Vietnam, and outperform the native-born white and black populations. So we want to pass along some of the lessons that come from those successful communities, from focusing on academia to saving money, honoring the millionaires and generals and so on in the black community and all communities in the past. That's the kind of curriculum we want to put out there, as opposed to 400 years ago, we were oppressed.
Well, let me ask you this then. Why is the 1619 Project, why do you think it really exists? Because is it just to complete or continue the narrative? Is it to prevent independent thought or reason? Is it ignorance, or is it a nefarious birth for something like that?
I think that for most of the people reading the essays, and for that matter, for many of the authors, it's probably well-intentioned confusion, nothing nefarious. But I mean, I think when you look at the very top leadership of the contemporary American civil rights movement, Al Sharpton comes to mind. I enjoy some of his writing, but Sean King definitely comes to mind. I do think you get some people that know open-eyed what they're doing. As a political scientist, a quantitative political scientist, I find that there are only about 8 or 9 human moral universals. Don't eat people or have sex with your mother or whatever. Most behavior can be explained pretty well by incentives. People, as long as it's reasonably honorable, do what pays them, right? So, I mean, I think in the case of the modern quote-unquote civil rights movement, I mean, an obvious reality is that there is a substantial grievance industry in the USA. I mean, something like a 20th of the American economy, if you look at affirmative action programs, minority set-aside, so on, is based on the idea of continuing very intense ethnic conflict. And if that is, in fact, not ongoing, there's no particular reason to continue supporting those programs. And those programs support a range of enterprises. I mean, I mentioned, you know, the Reverend Al, and the Reverend Jesse. But more to the point, I mean, the Southern Poverty Law Center, for example, has a well-invested $470 million endowment. If the war is over, there's no more reason to write them a check. So I think that the descendants of the people who did noble work by opening Selma very often are sort of calling our attention to things in the past, or arguing that things today that would not traditionally have been considered racism are new forms of prejudice, white privilege, cultural appropriation. And at some level, some of them have to know that the reason for that is keeping, you know, the enterprise, quote unquote, going.
That's That's my belief into how we ended up with the existence of something called microaggressions that are affronts to somebody so minor that the person doing it didn't know it. The person it was done to didn't know it, but some woke third party observer managed to pick up on it and be offended on behalf of everybody. It's a scary thing.
Yeah. I mean, without just saying the same thing twice, if there's, so social science, again, is no longer Alfred Kinsey wandering up to people in bathrooms and asking things like, how big is it? I mean, we've gotten pretty good in terms of anonymous surveys and so on. And one of the things we've measured very, very definitely is that among whites, among middle-class blacks, among people of East Asian descent, traditional racism is largely a thing of the past. If you asked someone, would you kiss, would you openly make out with a beautiful woman of another race in a sexual environment, just consider a relationship, would you do this? 95% of guys are going to say yes. There's a very small cohort of remaining racists who wouldn't literally sleep with or date or even marry someone of another race. So that stuff, I mean, and another question, if you saw someone of a different ethnicity in your neighborhood, would you attack them? Would you object to a middle-class neighbor of a different race? These are all questions, do you think schools are ideally segregated? Not you demand that, but do you think they're a little better? These are all questions that would have gotten 30, 40, 50% yes rates in urban areas in the South 60 years ago. Now those figures are almost zero. So the percentage of people that wouldn't vote for a qualified political candidate of their party of a different race among both blacks and whites is like 6%. So we've seen this almost entirely vanish. Even the use of epithets. I mean, most people say something like the N word or even the C word now, rather than using the term to describe it. So, again, if you're someone that's in charge of a group dedicated to fighting racism that has an $800 million annual budget based on the fighting of racism, you might need to find some different kinds of racism. And
That's right. It's working for a living.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's where we get a lot of this crap. Like cultural appropriation, for example. Like one of the things you see in college environments is white city kids being told they're kind of too black. Women being criticized for having, you know, pretty blonde dreadlocks, or guys being told they shouldn't wear a dirty ghetto kid skateboarding t-shirt because DGK is a black brand, or this kind of thing. You know, if you have...
Well, you also see, and this is a problem that's coming from a white guy to a black guy, but one of the things that always drove me nuts is when black kids are told they're acting white when they do well. That seems wildly self-destructive, yet tolerated largely by these so-called civil rights leaders, or not tolerated, ignored.
Yeah, I think that this gets into, there are a whole bunch of weird adjunct definitions of racism that have come up recently. One of these is the idea that only whites can be racist. And I think that this occurred because not only did a lot of legitimate quantitative scientists point out that there's very little remaining racism, they or we also pointed out that if you're being honest, minorities like blacks and East Asians are at least as racist as whites. If you want to just look frankly at who opposes certain forms of interracial dating, it's not just white people. If you look at interracial crime in the USA between blacks and whites, that's consistently more than 70% black on white. So people started pointing this out in the 80s, early 90s, and the response from kind of the woke brigade was to say, well, only white people can be racist because of their superior position of power. Leaving aside
the race plus power equals racism. I remember that from my education in the first season of The Real World. But really, that was the first time I'd ever heard that. And it was like, really, that's incredibly stupid. Racism is pretty obvious what the definition is. Yeah. But I suppose when you want to, people always find a way to absolve themselves from wrongdoing.
Yeah, but that's why, the reason we got onto this is that's why telling a black kid, hey, you're acting like a white boy, and then taking a book from him would not be considered racist. It's an openly racist act, but you can't be racist because you're in a minority group. A lot of people are even now making this argument about cultural appropriation. I think I may have inspired it. I was on a mostly black radio show at one point, and they were talking about cultural appropriation, and I asked, if cultural appropriation is real, can I wear pants? Because, you know, back in the day, we wore robes. You guys in the northern climates that developed the trouser. So I asked if I could wear pants and shoes, and everyone just went silent for a while. I've done this a couple times on Twitter and so on, and I've noticed people starting to respond to this argument actually by saying, well, Riley, you need to understand that we are not capable of culturally appropriating. So I may have changed the dialogue there.
But you have my permission to wear pants. All right, to go as the duly designated representative of white people, everybody can wear pants.
You have my permission if you want to put a braid in your beard or hit a drum with your hands if we're going to approve ethnic stuff. So, like, maybe I could approve you to, like, use a spear if you ever need to, too, and you could let me use a bow. I mean, because, like, all people have been inventing shit for a really long time. But, I mean, like,
it's all.
I'm sorry?
It's all good, but I did do dreadlocks once, and it wasn't pretty.
Fair enough. And obviously, I mean, the show I described occurred. I forget which one it even was, though. So I don't know if I changed the cultural appropriation debate, but yeah, could have. But anyway, but that is one of the things you see, the idea that minorities are incapable of any of this stuff. I will say, by the way, that's an incredibly stupid argument. What it does is confuse the individual with the group level of analysis. This is like eighth grade social studies level of logic. So it's true on average that black people have slightly less power than whites. I think the average black guy makes a bit under 90% of what the average white guy does. But that would only matter if all black guys were in conflict with all white guys. In practice, if you look at those same statistics, you're probably talking about 45 to 50% of African Americans, 45 to 49 or whatever, that out-earned the average white dude and thus have more power. So, like, obviously, even using that silly-ass example, I could be racist to a janitor at my college as a tenured professor sitting in a big chair, you know? So if you really want to take the argument seriously at all, it still fails. But the underlying link of all of these things is that there is a desire to kind of create and coin these new forms of racism and, you know, keep the old game going.
Hey, there's money in it, and it sure beats the hell out of working for a living. Wilfred Riley, the university, or Kentucky State University, I intended this to be a half an hour. We've gone an hour, so I want to thank you for coming out. Tell people where they can find your work and find out about the 1776 Project again.
Sure thing. I always love the blatant plug at the end. I am Wilfred Riley. You can find my work really pretty widely these days. I mean, all three of my books are available on Amazon. Taboo, 10 Facts You Just Can't Talk About is the most recent, came out of Regnery, pretty well reviewed so far. I'm also available on the Twitter and the Facebooks under that name, Wilfred Riley. And I definitely encourage people, really anyone, white or black, who is has some questions about the current racial narrative or member of any other racial group, obviously, to check us out.
Say what? No Asians? What's the deal?
No. we're open bigots, Derek. I mean, no, you can check us out at www.1776unites.org. You'll see kind of the essays that represent the project. I mean, there are opportunities to volunteer, to give, to contribute. So definitely check that out. And thanks for having me on the air.
Thanks for coming on. And thanks to everybody for listening. That is all the time we have. We'll be back with another exciting episode tomorrow. Stay safe, stay inside, stay sane.